Ah, the start of the week and plenty to catch your ear on the radio, from one woman's experience of being stalked and harassed to an Oscar nod for Irish-made film Wolfwalkers and more epic tales of love on the live line. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran and here's what you might have missed.
He was in the bushes in front of my bedroom with his beard shaved off and his hair shaved off and his eyebrows shaved off.
90% of my thought patterns were around where can I get money for gambling? How can I make up excuses of how I've spent my time to loved ones? And it was all consuming.
Yeah, it's great to get an accolade like this. You know, a nomination is the win for us.
And it's not your first nomination. This is, am I correct in saying number five?
For Cartoon Saloon, yes. It would be number five, yeah. Three features and a short nominated for the Oscars before this.
And we'll start in the morning and this very sensitive interview from the Ryan Tuberty Show. Eve McDowell was talking about her experience of being stalked while studying in Galway in 2017 when she encountered Igor Lewandowski.
So I was studying for a year in NUIG from 2017 to 2018.
Mm-hmm.
He would have been in the same college campus accommodation as me. So I was in NUIG studying arts.
Okay, and there's nothing like an arts degree to have a bit of fun in your life, and I hope you had lots of fun up until this point. Were you enjoying it all?
Yeah, I was there for a year and then I just decided I didn't really enjoy the course. Mm. So I stayed in Galway and got a job down here.
Okay, and you remained mixing with your college pals anyway because you were of an age,
yeah.
And that's what happened. Tell me about Igor Lewandowski and how he entered your social circle.
Well, we had some mutual friends in Carr Village. We weren't really in the same circle, but it's a small place, like everyone does get to know everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I never really spoke to him much one-on-one. He used to come into the clothes shop that I was working in a good bit. But, you know, he was quiet enough individual. He didn't have great social skills. He was a little bit introverted.
But people knew him.
Yeah. And he seemed to stand out a little bit.
In what way?
He was always around,
yeah.
But he never said much. He
okay.
was observant.
And when did you kind of think, well, that's a little peculiar behaviour-wise. What was your first inkling, Eve?
I suppose it was maybe April or May 2019.
Mm-hmm.
He had been coming into the shop a lot and then there was rumours he went off the radar and no one had kind of seen him for a few months. And then he started showing up outside the shop. He used to sit on the bench outside and walk past rather than come in. And, you know, he did used to buy a lot of things in there. One of my friends told me that he changed his Tinder occupation to a rep for the clothes shop that I worked in. Just little things like
sure.
that.
And they all started, I presume, to add up. You had spoken to him, hadn't you? At a party?
From time to time.
Yeah.
And like a party situation, but that would have been nearly a year beforehand.
Yeah. And from standing around the shop and standing outside, where did it start to progress from there?
There was one morning that I noticed he was outside from like 9:30 that morning. I went to lunch with a friend then in a restaurant just off Fair Square.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see him pass by and he kind of looked in. And that's when I told my friend, I was like, look, he's been around since 9:30 this morning. And my friend assured me, look, you know, Galway's small. People do pop up a lot. And then we went and we sat in Air Square and then we could see him at the opposite side of Air Square sitting in. So told a few more people, I went back to work, and then at four o'clock another friend called in and said that she had seen him looking in the window and that he was on the bench outside the shop. So, you know, at this point I told staff and I alerted the shopping centre security that I thought something might be up.
Yeah.
And then I finished work and when I left there was no sign of him. I went to a pub across Air Square and I was telling another friend and then surely enough a few minutes later she said, look, that's him over there. And once he noticed that I spotted him, he scurried out. So we said, like, right, let's move. So we moved to a different pub and we chose a window seat to keep an eye out and see if he'd pop up again. And he did. He was walking up and down. So at this point it was like 10 o'clock at night. So he had spent from 9:30 that morning 10 o'clock that night, he was just around. And after that, we went to McDonald's and I could see him walking past McDonald's again. So at that point, me and my friend went out to confront him, and he ran down a side street off of Shop Street, and he was crouched down behind a van. And my friend said, "What are you doing? Why are you following Eve?" Mm-hmm. And he just started laughing and ran away. And then that's when I was like, "Look, I can spot you a mile away with that beard. You're not doing a great job."
Yeah. Hiding. But it sounded like, "Oh, you big Egypt or what have you." But
yeah.
But it was much more sinister than that, I would imagine, for
it
you.
It was, yeah, and yeah, it, definitely.
Was and it then hard? He, go ahead, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, then like we left, two of my friends decided to walk me home, and he showed up then twice again on the route home. So, you know, that's when I started really worrying.
And so Eve spoke about the events of May 17th, 2019.
So I went out and I stayed at a friend's house. We shared a taxi back to, she lived in the estate beside me.
Yeah.
And then I was walking back to my house that morning. We never would have locked the front door during the day, you know, always at night. But, you know, I came in, it was 9:15 in the morning, and I just thought, I don't know, something just didn't sit right with me. So I locked the front door.
Yeah.
I went into the kitchen and put on the kettle, and as I was coming back into the hall, I could see a figure looking on. We had frosted glass beside the door, but I didn't recognise it. The door handle then tried to open, and then there was a knock, so I just thought maybe it was a delivery driver. I got the keys just from the radiator beside the door, and I opened the door, and there was no one there, which shocked me because there's steps up to our door. So then I closed the door and immediately locked it. I texted into the house group chat to see if, you know, someone was expecting a package or expecting someone. And then one of my housemates came down, and we went into my bedroom, and he was in the bushes in front of my bedroom with his beard shaved off and his hair shaved off and his eyebrows shaved off.
Good Lord, what a strange transformation physically, if nothing else.
Yeah, I couldn't. It didn't feel real, you know.
Well, this is a gear change then in terms of his stalking, because it's mm-hmm. one thing looking through shop window, it's another arriving at your door, and you're now straight to the Gardaí, I take it.
Yeah, yeah. Rang the guard straight away. They came down and they said, "Look, you know, we can caution him. That's all we can really do for now." And I just remember at that point thinking, you know, nothing can be done until something happens.
We'll come back to that, because the fact that it's only a caution, it doesn't feel like enough in terms of protecting people who are being stalked. But that's for a few minutes' time. Let's go along, if you don't mind, Eve, with your story.
Yeah, of course.
As you're doing so well telling the story. And in that regard, we're staying in May, are we, in 2019?
Yeah.
And you, at this time, I take it you're having trouble focusing and concentrating and just living a normal life.
Yeah, like luckily I had a few days off, so I decided to go home, and you know, that's when I realised that the effect had really taken its toll, when I was going for walks at home out in the countryside and still looking over the shoulder, and you know, I hadn't been walking anywhere on my own from the night that he, you know, from that full day where he followed me. So, you know, I just didn't feel safe anywhere at that point.
Especially your own home. Of all places where you should be feeling the safest. May 27th, Eve, you're at home, and there's developments then again.
Yeah, I came back that day, and a friend met me off the bus and walked me home. Mm-hmm. And then the guy I was seeing at the time came to the house and collected me, and we went into town and got some food. And by this point as well, I had started taking different walkways everywhere, you know, detours, and just changing up the way I walk to and from work or anywhere. So we were walking through NUIG campus, and that's when he said, "Look, don't look over there. Just keep walking. Just keep walking." And, you know, surely enough, he was there again. And we went into town. I tried to forget about it, but we were walking back into my estate, and I spotted him in the bushes of the house opposite my house.
Okay. You must be sick in the stomach at this stage.
Yeah. Yeah. I just rang the guards and ran inside, but didn't know where he was or what he was capable of.
And that uncertainty must have been debilitating.
Yeah, yeah, because every possibility goes through your head.
And then Igor Lewandowski made his move.
I couldn't sleep then that night afterwards. Mm-hmm. I was just up all night. I just had a feeling. I kept thinking I could hear the steps and rustling outside. One of my housemates was sleeping on the couch because she had forgot her bedroom key. Mm-hmm. Like, we were all locking our bedroom doors and everything at this point. So she was asleep on the couch, and once it got bright, then I got up to go to the bathroom, and that woke her up. So I went back to the room and I was kind of sitting up, and then next thing I heard her screaming, saying, "Oh my God, it's him, get out, get out." And just loads of banging, and I didn't know what was happening. So I just jumped up, and I had my hands on the bedroom door at first, and she told me he was gone, and I opened the door and she was standing there with a hammer. So he had actually had scaffolding set up on a couple of balconies down and scaled across. And, you know, he must have noticed her open the balcony door, noticed that she was falling back asleep, and he tried to run past her. But once she woke, he ran towards her with the hammer. And she managed to, you know, throw a blanket over him, which kind of set him off, and he jumped off the balcony then. And the guards, we called the guards. Initially, while we were waiting for the guards to come, we could hear banging from, and it turned out to be next door. Mm-hmm. But we thought he got in the house again, and, you know, we were all in my room with the door locked, furniture up against the door, just
God, like a horror film. You know, it's, mm-hmm. it's, did you say he'd built a scaffold?
Yeah. So he had done it a couple of balconies down so that I wouldn't see it. I don't know how long it was there for, how many times he had been up, but
he jumped off the balcony to escape, mm-hmm. and he wouldn't be getting too far now before the guards found him crawling along, I take it.
No, yeah, I think he broke his ankle, so they found him crawling up the road behind the estate.
And what did they do with him then?
They detained him straight away. He has been detained ever since. Now, they managed to find a knife and Viagra below the balcony as well. So they never did manage to get fingerprints on that, but we kind of have a fair idea where it came from and what the intentions were there.
And now you find yourself in court.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
Yeah. So he kept appealing the bail charges. So, you know, it was up to the High Court in Dublin, and having to sit there and look at him and talk about it over and over again. And, you know, it really can be re-triggering for victims.
What was that like? You faced him in court, did you? You weren't given the choice of maybe being a little more discreetly positioned in the courtroom?
Well, you know, you do get told, look, he's going to come. My detective told me where he'd be sitting and, you know, advised me just don't look at him. But, you know, his father was in there as well. And it's just strange. It's very strange. Like, it's so surreal in there.
I presume you found it hard to avoid looking at him. I mean,
yeah. Like, he was smiling at me up at the High Court from across the room.
How did that feel for you?
Oh, I just felt disgusted. I felt sick, you know. It just shows the lack of remorse that was there.
How did he plead?
He was saying that he wanted to have a conversation with me. So he pleaded guilty to breaking an entry. But I don't know. He just said he wanted to come in and talk to me.
And ultimately he was found guilty of what? And imprisoned for how long?
So breaking an entry, assault and harassment. There was two consecutive sentences. One was 5 years, one was 7 with 2 years suspended. So basically his approximate release date is the 23rd of March 2023.
You know that date right off by heart, don't you?
Yep, yeah.
Why, apart from the obvious?
Because I don't know where I go from there. I don't know what to expect. I don't know where he'll be or what he might do or if he'll pop up again.
Eve McDowell on the Ryan Tuberty Show. And on the news at 1, more good news for the makers of the Irish-made animation film Wolfwalkers.
Irish-made film Wolfwalkers has been nominated for an Oscar in the Best Animated Feature category in the nominations, which are out this lunchtime. The film from Cartoon Saloon in Kilkenny tells the story of a young apprentice hunter and her father who travel to Ireland to help wipe out the last wolf pack. We're joined now by our arts and media correspondent, Sinead Crowley, and by one of the directors of Wolfwalkers, Ross Stewart. Hello, Ross, and thanks for taking our call. Terrific news for you today. Terrific.
It is. It's fantastic news, all right. The whole crew was watching the live feed this morning on a big joint Zoom call, and we all had a big cheer when her name came out. So it's great news, all right.
Tell us a bit about Wolfwalkers. I mean, it is out, so perhaps many of our listeners will have seen it. But I suppose, like a lot of Cartoon Saloon's output, it's very much an Irish story, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Tom and myself are, you know, we are from Kilkenny, so we set the film in Kilkenny, and it tells a story in the 1650s in Kilkenny when Oliver Cromwell was attacking the town and trying to wipe out the wolves in Ireland. And it's very much a story of two little girls from across this divide that become friends, you know, so it's got a good heartwarming message at its centre. But yeah, it's been in the making for 7 years. And it got finished last year. It got a limited cinema release because of the COVID guidelines, but some people might have seen it in the cinemas. And then, yeah, it's great to get an accolade like this. You know, a nomination is the win for us.
Of course. And it's not your first nomination. This is, am I correct in saying, number five?
For Cartoon Saloon, yes. It would be number five, yeah.
Yeah. So we
had three features and a short nominated for the Oscars before this.
And what are you feeling are your chances this time round?
Well, it's very hard for us to compete in such a big Hollywood kind of event like that, you know. So really the nomination is the win, you know, for us, because, you know, going up against the likes of Disney and Pixar and that is a tough battle. So really just to be in the race is the kind of the victory for us.
Yeah, well, as I say, Sinead Crowley is here with us. And I think Sinead's, you feel definitely that Wolfwalkers is in strongly in contention.
Yeah, obviously they're being modest there in Cartoon Saloon this afternoon. They really are seen as a contender. I mean, obviously anyone in the race is a contender, but it's seen, I think, as a two horse race this time between Wolfwalkers and Disney Pixar Soul. And I mean, this film, it's an absolutely beautiful film. Actually, my own family got to see it in a cinema in the brief time it was in the cinema and were completely entranced by it. So it's a fantastic achievement. And again, look, five Oscar nominations from this Irish based, you know, we really have to celebrate that today. It's wonderful.
Yeah. So what else? Looking down at the nominations, you were saying to me before we came back from the break, diversity is a big theme this year.
And I mean, the Oscars had been criticised so much in recent years. You've had Oscars so white and, you know, the lack of women, the lack of people of colour and so on. So they certainly have gone some way towards addressing that. For the first time, there are two women up in the Best Director category, Chloe Zhao and Emerald Fennell, both up in the Best Director category, and both of their films nominated for Best Film as well. And there's also, I believe, just doing a quick tot around, 9 out of the 20 actors are black or people of colour in the acting category. So, and also you'd have people like Chadwick Boseman, that very sadly died last August. He's up for Best Actor and definitely, you know, is almost a dead cert to win there. So hopefully that will be the plan. You will see, you know, more female winners, more people from across various genres winning. Mm. And that is, will certainly be seen to be a positive thing about the shortest.
Strange the year, though. For the most part, these movies haven't had cinema releases, have they?
This is the thing. So they had to look at films that were streaming or had started in films and had gone to streaming and so on. But then again, you might argue maybe it'll let, you know, other films in that mightn't have been considered before. And also you've got the situation where a lot of people in Ireland simply haven't seen all of the films at this stage. So, you know, it could be a case where a film could win and then maybe appear here later on. So it will be very strange. But at the same time, I suppose, positive for the industry that it is happening in April, which is very late. The nominations are late, but it is happening, I suppose, to show that, look, that the films are being made and hopefully will come back, because obviously cinemas, this has been an incredibly tough time for cinemas. Whatever about the film industry making films and then streaming, cinemas themselves are really up against it with COVID closure.
So, and do we know at this stage the award ceremony itself, what's planned, what might be possible?
We don't know exactly, but I suppose looking at other ceremonies like, you know, like the Grammys and like the Golden Globes, you would imagine a mixture of online and in person. So they're not as interesting to watch maybe, but, you know, they will be keeping going. And you'll see lots of people sitting rooms again and kitchens and getting dressed up to sit in their sitting rooms for an award. So I suspect that's what to expect in April.
And most of the movies available are on some platform somewhere, if you want
to, including platform near you.
Including Wolfwalkers.
Including Wolfwalkers, which again, I would highly recommend. It's an incredible achievement.
Sinead Crowley. Crowley on the News at One with Brian Dobson. Now from Today with Claire Byrne, the invisible job, all the tasks that are heaping up for someone to do. But is that someone always the female in the family? Paula Fiennes was talking to Claire in the morning.
This sparked a lot of conversation and discussion in our office this morning. And I know that you say you haven't met one other woman who hasn't gone through this experience.
Well, I think that the invisible job is remarkably common to all of us. And that's what I discovered from the lots of women that I've interviewed in the course of writing this book.
So what is the invisible job?
Well, it means two basic things. The first is everything that goes into just creating a home, one that feels nice to live in and enables your life to function. So that's all the basic things like having clean clothes, having insuring the car, having insurance, eating. But a second big part is all the work that involves comes along when you become a parent, because that's when the invisible job really mushrooms into an enormous undertaking.
So what are the additional invisible jobs that come with parenting?
Well, when you become pregnant with your first child, many women diligently try and ensure that they know what's coming. They focus on all the baby-related things. But actually, there's very little that can prepare you for the big shock, both for both men and women, of what happens. It's like falling down the world's highest water slide and you can barely come up for air for a month. And you're just hoping that there's going to be a curve where things will level out. But it doesn't for a very long time. It's an exhausting experience of just trying to keep up to speed with nappies and feeding. But it does eventually calm down. You think, okay, great, you know, now that baby phase is over, things will be easier from now on. But surprisingly, and this has been echoed by all the women I've spoken to, the job doesn't stop there. You're only starting at that point. And it starts to evolve, but grow when you have all kinds of children's activities and schools and the communication that goes with that and homework and health and looking after cutting nails and having showers and baths and more cooking and more laundry. And the scale of it to women who are, because I'll come back to this, but it is largely women to whom most of this
falls. You see, I'm waiting now for my screen to fill with texts from men who put out the bins, who empty the dishwasher, who mow the lawn and who feel very hard done by when we're talking about the invisible job, which is the female burden.
I can completely understand that because men absolutely want to play their part. The unfortunate thing is they can only see part of the picture. And it's not their fault. Even the women who are absolutely submerged trying to do all of the invisible job, they can't even tell you how big it is themselves because they're just in the middle of it. It's huge. And if you could see it all mapped out on a page, you'd stand back and go, oh, my God, do I really do all of that?
And that's what you've done. You've written down the list of invisible jobs.
I have, together with the input from lots of other women, I have. And if you were to map it all out on a page, like a job description, it's really beneficial because this enables couples who are about to enter that phase in their lives to have a clear picture of what lies ahead of them. And if you know what it involves, then you both appreciate and can work out together. How are we going to tackle this? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's easy though, looking ahead. As you say, until you fall down the water slide, you really don't know what's ahead of you.
You don't, but you can be prepared. And I wish 25-year-old me had a copy of The Invisible Job because you would have had a more realistic expectation of what's ahead of you. But it just enabled you to plan. You know, it's something you both want to do, you're both committed to doing to the best of your ability, men and women. But if you are not prepared for what's coming, the default is that all of these brand new responsibilities just gravitate more to women than they do to men.
Can I ask you what is the big difference between the way women view tasks and the way men view them?
Yes. Men are very willing to help. They're very willing to help on the basis of opting in. So they'll opt in happily if you ask them to do something. But somehow our conditioning just enables women, it causes women to defaults all of that responsibility to them. So, for instance, there's a wonderful woman I worked with when I was pregnant. Her name was Dr. Jane Anderson. And she said to me, she just pulled me aside and said, you know, word of advice, men opt in. And I didn't really know what she said, what she meant. And she said, for instance, if I ask my husband, okay, Saturday morning, can you mind the kids? Because I've got to go to the hairdresser. He'll say, Saturday, absolutely, no problem. I'll just put that in the diary. And then he'll then turn around a few minutes later and say, when will you be back? Like, in other words, this job that I've opted into, when can I opt back out? But he said, at the same time, if Clive is planning to spend all of Sunday at an Arsenal match, they live next door to Arsenal Stadium, he will never think to ask me, can I mind the kids? So the problem is just that despite their willingness to co-parent, it's just a bit of a blind spot for the default always falling back to women.
Paula Fiennes from Today with Claire Byrne. It's crushing to be expecting the vaccine and then find out the day before that it's been postponed. The pause on the AstraZeneca vaccine. Morning Ireland reporter Joan O'Sullivan spoke to some of the people affected.
My name's Nicole and I work in a pharmacy, so we were all due to get the vaccine. I was due to get it today, Sunday. I just got a text message this morning that said due to government directive, all vaccine appointments are cancelled. So a colleague of mine got hers yesterday.
And how do you feel about the fact that it was cancelled?
Disappointed. I was just looking forward to getting it and it would have kind of felt like the beginning of the end of restrictions and just being a bit more protected when I'm at work. I obviously know they have to investigate it. Like, you wouldn't want blood clots, like, it'd be nasty. But I just don't really understand how they only kind of decided to do it on a Sunday when yesterday my colleague got it and it was apparently fine. Like, these Norwegian cases were kind of, like, I've read about them a couple of days ago, so I don't know why it was just all of a sudden today. It's not okay to do it.
My name is Carmel O'Connor, and I work with a youth project called the Talk About Youth Project. And last Friday, I got a call from Tuzla, and the appointment was offered for tomorrow at 9:30 a.m. in City West.
So that's when you were due to get your vaccine. And what happened today?
I got a call just telling me that it had been postponed. You know, there's obviously concerns if NIAC, you know, want to investigate the usage of that vaccine here. So, you know, I was only happy to be called in the first place. So, you know, it's just a case of sitting tight, you know, and getting a new appointment.
Many people with a medical condition that puts them at very high risk of severe disease and death were also due to get the AstraZeneca jab this week as part of the rollout to Cohort 4. Aisling O'Rourke is in this category and had been anxiously awaiting her appointment date.
I have severe asthma, type 1 diabetes and a number of other autoimmune diseases. The logical part of me understands why the decision's been made, that the government has to proceed with caution. But I'm disappointed when the announcement was made that I was in cohort 4. For the first time in my life, being as vulnerable as I am was a good news thing to me. It meant that I had some kind of a goal as to when I could do the simple things like give my goddaughter a hug. Now that it's all up in the air again, I think the best way to describe it, it just feels like musical chairs. I don't really know how I feel about it, and I don't really know where I stand either.
And then Gavin Jennings spoke to Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly.
Only last week this vaccine was said to be cleared for people over the age of 70, and you and the Taoiseach were pushing the company for more. Your counterpart in the north, mindful and watchful of what's happened in Norway, is still going ahead. Do you have any hesitancy in stopping this vaccine now?
No, I don't. And I think when you listen to Nicole, Carmel and Aisling, you can hear the real disappointment, because these vaccines are the light at the end of a tunnel, the light at the end of a very, very dark year. And the data we're getting from their effectiveness is nothing short of astonishing for all three vaccines that we're using here in Ireland. And so naturally people are disappointed. But I think, as they all voiced as well, what I want, and I think what your listeners want, is for the people, the clinical leaders of this vaccination program, to be taking a very safety conscious, cautious approach. And really, that's what they've done. So late Saturday night, new information came in about four cases in Norway. They NIAC and the HPRA immediately reviewed that and decided to act, I think, decisively and quickly. And what we hope is for a very short period of time. So my hope is that the EMA will report back very positively later on this week, and that Nicole, Carmel and Aisling and all the others who were due to get AstraZeneca this week will be rescheduled in the very near future.
Who won't get their vaccine this week because of the suspension?
There will be about 30,000 people who won't get the vaccine this week, and it's a combination of healthcare workers, frontline healthcare workers, and those in cohort four. So this is the new cohort that NIAC identified as those being at very high risk due to underlying conditions. And Aisling was an example of someone in that cohort.
Many of those, as you said, who will now have to wait are people under the age of 70 at bigger risk of getting sick, a group of around 160,000 people. How many of the targeted 10,000 people got their vaccine last week?
Well, we'll have to review that now, because obviously a number of those were scheduled, as I think Nicole was saying, she was scheduled for Sunday and they were cancelled at the last minute. So we'll get the final report from the HSE. But my understanding is a lot of good progress was being made last week, and many thousands of people in that cohort.
Do you have an estimate for how many last week? We were asking you on Friday and you said you would have a clearer picture on Sunday. Do you know now?
Well, I'll need to talk to the HSE, because obviously we cancelled yesterday. So probably by the end of today, we'll have an accurate figure from the HSE.
The aim, according to Professor Martin Cormacan, the HSE's head of infection control, who we spoke to last week on the programme, is that most of that group of 160,000 people will have got their first dose this month. Will that target be changed now?
Well, those, first of all, these aren't targets. These are estimates based on delivery schedules from AstraZeneca. So if the EMA comes back, as we hope they will, with a very positive report later on in the week, then it'll be a very short period to reschedule, because what we've done is we've built a vaccine system, or are building a vaccine system, with the capacity to administer more vaccines than we've had in. So hopefully the 30,000 for this week will be rescheduled very, very quickly. So will everybody be done within the time left in March? I'd say pretty close. Possibly, maybe there'd be a bit of spillover into April, but very, very quickly.
Just to be clear, you expect that most of that 160,000 people will have got their first dose this month?
No, sorry, I'm talking about the 30,000, Gavin, for this week. What I'm saying is we should be able to reschedule them, and in so doing, not have to delay other people. In other words, do the 30,000 at the same time as people who we were planning on doing in the coming weeks as well.
And when do you now expect most of that group to have had their first dose?
Well, we need to really wait and see, because the AstraZeneca program has been temporarily suspended. So what we have to do now is see what the EMA says. Our hope, obviously, is that they come back very positively. I think, as was covered in the introduction, AstraZeneca itself has made the point that there have been less than 40 reports across Europe, including the UK. Now, that's 17 million people who've been vaccinated. And actually, AstraZeneca's statement goes further, and it says that the incidence of blood clotting in the vaccinated population is, in fact, less than you would see in a non-vaccinated population. So the hope is that the EMA will come back very shortly with a positive result, and we'll crack on.
Health Minister Stephen Donnelly from Morning Ireland with Gavin Jennings. And in the afternoon, those epic love stories stranger than fiction. Did you miss Eileen's story on Liveline on Friday? Well, here's Joe with a recap.
From Eileen on Friday and the cattle truck driver and the cattle dealer and the dealer who drove her to the driver, and she was absolutely head over heels with the driver, and he was head over heels with Eileen. They were both 25. She just back from the States. And the dealer then told Eileen and their family that the driver had been killed driving the truck, or his employee Eileen was heartbroken and went on with her life, was going to go back to the States, but then she met someone and he said, don't go back, marry me. And she said, absolutely. And they were driving 2 days before the wedding in around Killarney, and around the corner comes the truck and the dead driver, so to speak, is driving. As she said, she jumped out of the car, said, you're back from the dead, you're resurrected. I was told you were deceased. And he said, who told you that? And she explained. And at this stage, I'm seeing Saoirse Ronan and Paul Mescal now in these two roles, and Michael Fassbender as the dealer. But anyway, the driver said, well, you're getting married in 2 days, it should be me. And Eileen said, well, everything is planned for the wedding. And as their most poignant phrase in the whole 75 minutes when she captured the hearts of the nation on Friday was, I would have gladly walked up the aisle with the two of them. I was torn between two lovers. Now, by the way, we've had quite a few suggestions, and obviously we can't be throwing out names of either the dealer, the driver, who drove her to Eileen away, but the dealer drove Eileen away from the driver. But we are following inquiries, and we're going through, obviously there's GDPR and things like that, but we're going through a number of suggestions, and we'll keep you, hopefully we'll have it sorted by St. Patrick's Day. We're on tomorrow. Elizabeth Robertson. Elizabeth, good afternoon. You were listening to Eileen, her story about long distance love. You have a story about long distance love.
Hey, Joe. I do indeed.
Tell us.
It was 1981.
Okay.
I was on holiday with my friends over in Ibiza.
Okay.
The Holiday Island, as it was called then.
Yeah.
We were on the quiet side of the island, so we used to go into San Antonio just for the pubs and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And this night, we were outside an Irish pub called Joe Spoon's, which is still there, and these Scottish boys came over and started talking to us.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, this guy was talking to my friend, and she said, oh, I can't understand what he's saying.
Okay.
Will you talk to him?
Right.
So she said, I said, okay. So I started talking to this fella anyway, and he was really nice, and I think he was the first boy that ever bought us a drink. So
okay.
she liked him then, so we had a drink with him, and we were all going off dancing, and mm-hmm. everywhere was open till all hours in the morning, as you can imagine. So anyway, he said to me, will you come back and meet me tonight? And I said, yeah, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
I said, we'll go back and I'll come back in tonight. So we exchanged our addresses, our home
okay.
addresses. And
well, your home was in Ireland, did I say?
Yeah, I lived
okay.
in Dublin.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Okay.
yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, it was Diane and Charles's wedding.
Oh, in 1981, okay. Yeah,
yeah, so there was parties all over the beach, but we didn't know who they were, but we still partied with them anyway.
Course,
so
yeah.
Went back, and I ended up getting sunstroke, too much sun and too much champagne. So
yeah.
I needn't tell you, I never got back that night to see him.
Uh-huh.
And then,
what was his name? Alec? Alec,
yeah.
Alec, okay.
Yeah, so I was going home a couple of days later, but he was just beginning his holiday. So I went home, and
okay.
when my dad seen me at the airport, he says, where were you? I was so skinny, I never ate.
Oh, God.
And I had all these blisters.
And what was Alex's second name?
It's Robertson.
So if there's an Alex Robertson listening, we want him to get in touch, is that it?
No, I'm married to him.
Oh, you're I was wondering where the accent was coming from.
Yeah, no, I'm married to him. What happened was I never got back to meet him that night. So
okay.
when I went home, I went back to work, and I came home from work one night, and my dad said to me, who do you know in Ibiza? And I said, I don't know anybody in Ibiza. Yeah. He says, well, there's a card there for you. So I was like, a card for me? And then I read it, and it was from Alec, and he had wrote, to cut a long story short, I lost my mind. So I knew it was from him, because at that time we were all into Spandau Ballet, and so he had put his phone number on the card.
And what do you mean, what do you mean, Elizabeth, sorry, between you and me, I lost my mind? With excitement, was it?
No, it was a song. It was a line from a song. from Spandau Ballet at the time.
Okay, so
explain. Long story short, I lost my mind.
Okay. So this was written on the postcard?
That was written on the postcard,
and
yeah.
You can remember 40 years later what was written on that postcard?
Yeah, I can remember every single bit of that night, Joe, and here we are, we're 35 years married now in April.
That's Elizabeth on the live line with Joe Duffy. And in the morning, in a big week for horse racing, the issue of gambling addiction, particularly during lockdown. And on Today with Claire Byrne, Professor Colin O'Gara, consultant addiction psychiatrist, and Owen Coyne, recovering problem gambler.
Do you know, Claire, it's really funny. I had a dream last night that I was in the bookies and I was betting. And it's over 7 years since I've had a bet. And that dream reoccurs maybe once every 6 months. And definitely with Cheltenham coming up this week, obviously there's more advertising around it. And I suppose it's more to the fore. I definitely think that kind of ate away at my subconscious maybe over the last few days.
Isn't that interesting?
That I had that dream.
Maybe Professor O'Gara, you could explain why that happens, the dream about gambling.
Yeah, Claire, it's something that I would hear in my clinics all the time. It is basically what we call cue-evoked responses. So a cue could be anything. It could be a smell, it could be a sight, it could be a memory. So around Cheltenham, we're basically flooded with gambling cues, and you basically just can't avoid advertising and everybody talking about it. So people in workplaces, for instance, would be bombarded with talk about odds and what's going on at Cheltenham. Now, it's a little bit different this year because people aren't going, obviously, but
I feel there's even more talk about it, though, because people aren't going. It's everywhere. The ads are everywhere.
Yeah, you said it in your lead-in. I mean, basically, it is everywhere, and I would call it a crisis upon a crisis, because prior to Cheltenham and the lockdown and all the boredom and isolation that people have been under, there has been, you know, we've had a crisis basically where we haven't had any action on legislation for the best part of a decade, really. So, you know, that's the crisis prior to this. Now we've got lockdown on top of it. So very, very significant, yeah. Claire, yeah.
Before we talk about what might need to happen, Owen, I want to talk to you about your own story, because you were just 14 when the gambling bug bit you.
Yeah, I was. So I started gambling at the local Greyhound track, and I suppose getting people to go in and put a bet on a soccer match or Cheltenham or the Grand National would have been how it started. And innocently enough, didn't see it as something that was harmful to me. But over the next few years, and by the time I turned 16 and 17, I had a part-time job, and I'd get paid on a Friday, and at the end of the day, my wages would be lost, you know.
Yeah, when I was reading your story, Owen, I just felt really sorry for you, because you're just a child when that's happening and you're going home without even enough money for a bag of chips after your part-time job.
Yeah, it was really strange. And it was, I never even flagged it as a problem as such, you know. I just thought it was something that I'd made a mistake or something like that on an occasion, but then the occasions became more frequent, and it definitely is. It was a slow burner for me, and like by the time it came to a head, it was consuming an awful lot of my thoughts. 90% of my thought patterns were around where can I get money for gambling? How can I how can I make up excuses of how I've spent my time to loved ones and stuff like that? I would have been really good at masking what I was doing, but it was all consuming.
And Professor O'Gara spoke about the concerns around online betting.
We're very concerned about the online space, and apart from people presenting, Claire, to our treatment services, the bookmaker profits would indicate, online profits would indicate that there is a big problem there. Also, betting duties from the government for 2021, the first quarter, would also indicate a problem with the online space. So, you know, those betting duties are actually up on last year. So all the metrics point towards increased gambling, and it makes sense, because, you know, the items that you talk about in your lead-in, the boredom, the isolation, they're actually ideal conditions for relapse, you know.
Yeah, and you know, when I listen to Owen's story and I hear, as I said earlier on, I hear a child being drawn into this world. And that's the concern, isn't it? That there are children who are getting involved in this, be it online or going physically into the bookmakers. That's where the real problem starts, when this culture begins or this addiction begins, when you're not able to make an informed decision about what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, Claire, that the concerns with gambling disorder in Ireland are disparate and many. We have a lot of concerns about adults, treatment, research and all of that. But if you look purely at adverts that are bombarding kids at the moment on a Saturday afternoon when they sit down to watch a football match, and this is essentially an over-18s product. And, you know, we need to get in and sort this out. I am, you know, somewhat... looking forward to the fact that the minister is, this is James Brown, I had a discussion with him in recent weeks. He is looking at bringing in legislation in the autumn. We have heard this for many years, but I am confident this year, Claire, that we can move on it.
Because we're still waiting for our regulator, even though the legislation is there.
Yeah, that's what he's looking to bring in,
okay.
Is to get a regulator in by the autumn and then to build on top of that. Like, if we get that in this year, it would be fantastic.
Owen, just to come back to you in this Cheltenham week, and I can't get that image of that dream you had out of my head, but if other people are struggling or if they're early on in their recovery, this is, we know, a really difficult week for them and can be. What advice do you have for people who might be struggling?
I think it's just reach out, Claire. It's really hard to do, and I'm not saying that it's an easy thing, but just reach out to that person that you have full confidence in, whether it's a loved one, a friend, it might even be a stranger, like the Rutland Centre or problemgambling.ie. There's loads of services there for people to reach out if they don't feel comfortable in opening up to someone that they're close to, because it can be very difficult. Because I found it very difficult when I opened up, even telling my parents or siblings, some of my friends, because I thought that they'd maybe, you know, look at me or treat me differently, or I'd come across to them as being some sort of a failure to think that I have this behavioural addiction, because, I mean, it's not something that I was gripped by that's like a substance such as drugs or alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
But this behavioural addiction, I thought to myself, there's something wrong with me. I can't stop this and I should be able to, because I didn't really know anyone that had a problem with gambling as such, who spoke openly about it. So, you know, I thought that the problem was for me. But as I said, when I went and when I got professional therapy, I was living in London, and I got it through a charity called GamCare. And it was life changing. I was able to work with the therapist to find out where the root cause to the problem is. And that's the thing with any addiction, be it a substance or a behavioral addiction. It's getting to the root cause. And from then, like, I haven't looked back, and thankfully, I haven't had a bet. And if someone can get there, it opens up their world, and they can, you know, they can go on and they can live a good life.
Owen Coyne there from Today with Claire Byrne. And if you need some help, you can call Gamblers Anonymous on 01 872 1133. That's 01 872 1133. And on the Ryan Tubridy Show, this email got a huge reaction.
And so to this email I was telling you about, begins, "Dear Ryan, I'm writing this to you as yet another family tragedy occurs on a farm in Ireland. This country has had a long history of feuds, fighting and deaths over land and inheritance. And some people may not understand how someone could kill their brother or their mother or father over land. Whereas I'm one of the people who, while no one could condone this, I can certainly understand what causes it. I grew up working very hard, but also very happily on my family farm. I worked on the farm along with my father and brother after school or before school, every weekend, all the school holidays. I wasn't brought to swimming lessons or football training like other boys in my area, because in our family, the farm came first. But I didn't mind. I knew no different, and I truly loved farming. The outdoor lifestyle, working with animals and running your own family business. My parents, myself and my brother, worked hard to expand and develop it into a thriving business, buying more land as it became available in our locality. And I was reasonably bright in school, but was never overly encouraged by my parents to study hard, as it was a given that I would continue to work on the family farm. When we were teenagers, my older brother decided that he did not want to work on the farm, but wanted to go away to college. And I was all set to go to do a farming course. And this is where the injustice started. At the last minute, my brother decided that being away from home and studying hard was not all it was cracked up to be. He said he was not going to college and wanted to stay at home. My parents felt that the farm was not big enough for two brothers to make a good living. So after much fighting and tears, I was forced against my will to move away to go to college and get a job. I have never gotten over this. It has haunted me all my life. I have been in dark places thinking about the fact that I was cheated out of my dream job and lifestyle by my own family, for whom I worked hard all my life growing up. You cannot understand the pain of feeling like you are second best. My parents show little interest in my life, which my counsellor suggested may be their way of dealing with their guilt for what happened when they chose my brother over me because he is older and changed his mind at the last minute. It's not just the fact that my brother was handed our family business, the family home worth several million euro too. It's not just that the farm gives him an income that is multiples of what I earn in my so-called good job. It's not just that he is so wealthy and that he has a thriving business to hand down to his children. It's actually mainly the hurt that runs very, very deep that they chose him over me. It is made even more cruel by the fact that my young son is passionate about farming, and now he, like me, has to look at his cousins, who have all the livestock, all the machinery, the farmhouse, the big farm being handed to them, while he looks on in envy. I still have a dream to farm, to buy a small farm for myself and my son, but when you do not inherit this, it's almost impossible to save enough money after paying tax, mortgage and living to save enough to buy even a small farm. And people who inherit farms have no realisation of how lucky they are. I did a quick sum that if I was to try to buy what my brother was given, it would take me 10 lifetimes to save it. 10 lifetimes, and that's around 700 years. So yet he actually is so arrogant to think he has earned it in half a lifetime. So I can understand these family tragedies because I've had those feelings. I have contemplated taking my life on very dark days. The feelings of hurt and anger at the injustice are so strong that I can see why those tragedies happen, where the person wronged feels that they should pay for what they did. If it wasn't for wanting to be here for my wife and kids and the help I get from ongoing counselling, this could be our story. And it's taken me a long time to forgive my parents and my brother, but it is the only way I could continue to stay alive and to look at them every day, working the land, driving the tractors and jeep, living out the life that I so desperately wanted and still want for me and now for my son. It hurts to see my brother bringing his sons out on the farm with him every day, spending time with them and teaching them all I learned growing up on that farm while I'm stuck in an office job that I hate. I don't have this precious time with my son. I'm working hard to try to buy him a small farm, but it takes decades to do this when it's not given to you. Farming families need to take a long, hard look at how they divide up their farm. It's okay if one son doesn't want to farm, but when two or more desperately want to continue to farm and they decide to pick one, usually the oldest, then why should they expect peace? My family don't know how I feel because I cover it up, but it has eaten me up inside with feelings of sadness, anger, and bitterness, and the only way I could cope was to forgive them. It doesn't mean what they did was okay, it wasn't. So for the people who wonder how these tragedies happen, I don't wonder that. What I wonder is, how do they not happen more often? I wish to remain anonymous, but I'm happy for you to read out my letter, as I think it's an issue that affects lots of people in rural Ireland and serves as an explanation to non-farming people who listen to your show.
From the Ryan Tuberty Show. When it's the size of a bull, it's exhausted and it might have floated to Kerry accidentally from the Arctic. Alan Houlihan told Gavin Jennings in the morning about stumbling upon a walrus on the rocks in Valentia Island with his daughter.
So me and my daughter were adventuring down near the beach. We kind of were inside in a little wood and near the rocks, and Mirren spotted something in the water. So I thought it was a seal at first, and we went down to investigate, and I took out the phone and I started recording, and next thing it was a walrus, and he breached out of the water and give us a little show on the rocks. Mern thought he was just having fun, and it was just amazing.
They're very big. Did you know it was a walrus?
At first I didn't. But within seconds I knew it was a walrus. It's just the sheer size of it. It's the size of a cow or a bull, you know, in the water. You just couldn't. I hadn't seen anything like it before, in Ireland anyway.
Alan Houlihan from Morning Ireland with Gavin Jennings, then later on the Ray Darcy Show.
We got on to our friend Kevin Flannery, marine biologist and director of Dingle's Ocean World, and he's on the line now. How are you doing, Kevin?
I'm good, Ray. Good.
Good. Good to talk to you. So this is very rare, is it?
Absolutely very rare.
Okay.
I mean, these species live up in the Arctic, basically north of Greenland, north Canada, up around Russia, that part of the world. So very rarely would we get the occasional one coming down here. And sometimes they would have been washed ashore, maybe the carcass or something like that. But very rarely would you see a live one like this.
Okay. Well, any idea when the last sighting was of a live walrus?
Well, various people, some surfers said they see them off of Sligo, other person have said they've seen them off of Mayo, so there's been a number of different sightings of them, Ray, but
okay.
People can get a mix up with a bull seal as well, but
yeah.
The old fishermen used to call them the seals with whiskers, or with a beard, because basically they have whiskers and a beard as such.
And there's a difference in size as well, isn't there?
Oh, much different. I mean, they're three times the size of them. They grow up to about 4,000 or 5,000 pound weight.
What's that equivalent to now? What sort of other animal are we talking?
Ooh, basically for us, if we could look at a cow.
Right, that big.
Yeah, that big. Okay. I think the Norse word is horse or something they call them.
Right.
Small horse.
Now your friend Shamie Murphy, or is it Shawnee or Shamie?
Shawnee
Murphy sent you down pics of them. So you've been looking at them. So what can you tell us from looking at the pictures?
Well, it's a young walrus. Because the tusks haven't fully developed yet as such,
right.
Quite young, and it's pretty emaciated, and it was tired, extremely tired. It was just basically, wow, I've got ashore after coming across the Atlantic, and can I rest and do a bit of R&R over in Valencia? A great place to do R&R, by the way.
Yeah.
But it's dead there overnight, dead there all day yesterday, and obviously it's gone down, and hopefully because it would be hungry, because they fish in shallow waters. They have to go down to the bottom of the seafloor and they use their whiskers to find any clams or cockles or shellfish that would be hiding under the substrate. And then they dig them out with the tusks that they have,
okay.
The two canine tusks.
And how many thousands of miles is he away from home? Well, we don't know if it's a male. Or it is a male. We know it's a male.
Assuming it is a male from what of the photographs I've seen so far. But he... Basically around western Greenland, that sort of way would be the nearest area. And what I'm basically trying to say are a possibility that usually when they feed and they go up on the ice to stay away from polar bears and things like that, and he probably fell asleep up in it and wandered off too far offshore.
From the Ray Darcy Show. And that's it for Playback Daily this time. Thanks for listening and mind yourself till next time.